Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an investigation into the dark power of secret government that is the subject of a new film by the legendary documentary filmmaker Errol Morris, who joins us in the studio. He won an Academy Award for his film The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, and his other films include The Thin Blue Line, The Unknown Known, and his latest out on Netflix on December 15, Wormwood. This new four-hour film is an exploration of the mysterious death of Frank Olson, a CIA employee who was unwittingly dosed with LSD and was pushed or plunged to his death from a New York City hotel window in 1953. The film follows the odyssey of Olson's son, Eric, who tries to piece together the mystery behind his father's death and uses dramatic scenes acted out by Peter Sarsgaard and Molly Parker to make the case that the CIA, which later apologized for drugging Frank Olson, also had him murdered and spent decades covering up its crime. Then we'll look into the growth of a spin-off of the military-industrial complex President Eisenhower warned about, the nuclear industrial complex, and speak with William Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. The author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, he joins us to discuss his article at Tom Dispatch, Massive Overkill Brought to You by the Nuclear Industrial Complex. We will analyze the insanity of the skewed priority of the massive investment about to be made by the Trump administration to spend $1.7 trillion on a new generation of bombers, submarines, and missiles and the warheads that go with them that can only be used in ending the world as we know it, in a race of redundancy to improve on the quality of death at the expense of the quality of life in America. And joining us now in the studio is Errol Morris, a writer and filmmaker whose film The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature in 2004. He's the author of Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography, a book of his essays, and his latest book is A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald, both of which were New York Times bestsellers. His other films include Gates of Heaven, The Thin Blue Line, and The Unknown Known. And his latest film is Wormwood, which will be out in theaters and on Netflix on December the 15th. Welcome to Background Briefing, Errol Morris. So since we're in an era of alternative facts and fake news and there's no longer a consensus in this country about what is true and what is real. And I find that...
Was there ever?
Well, I think in the days of Uncle Walter Cronkite and the three anchors, I think the ratings indicated that most people got their news from the three main networks and at least believed them. And as far as I can tell, Uncle Walter was not lying. He wasn't a propagandist like we have now, particularly with Fox and Breitbart and these other overtly propagandistic outlets. So I detect there was a famous book, The Paranoid Style of American Politics. Maybe it's always been, there's been conspiracy theories and out there, but I don't think it's been so metastasized into the media landscape as it is today.
So much has changed over the years. It's important to remember how important truth is. But truth is never given to us. It's fought for, it's investigated, it's pursued. What's different about the landscape? So many things are different. I blame the internet for a lot of what is going on. I like to say that 100 years ago, 99.99% of human idiocy went unrecorded. Now we have the internet. And the founding fathers, certainly when they thought about the importance of the First Amendment, never envisioned a world where there would be a glut, not necessarily of information, but a glut of writing, a glut of opinion, so much so. And I would include myself as well. There's a loss of bearings. Where in hell am I? I still read as much as I ever have, but years ago, say 1,000 years ago when I was young, I would read a book, I would know which book I was reading. I would pick up the newspaper, usually the New York Times, and I would know which paper I was reading. There was a source for information. You could track it back. It had a provenance. Today, I'll be reading on a computer. I have no idea where the information comes from. And it's a frightening thought. Donald Trump isn't the first president who's lied to us, make no mistake. What makes him worse than anything I've ever seen before is he's such a bad liar. I expect from my presidents a better level of mendacity and prevarication. This is pathetic.
Well, you know, I often think the internet has created a situation somewhat, to use Winston Churchill's Battle of Britain admonition, never before in the field of human endeavor has so much been said by so many about so little. And that there is, of course, in defense of the Kardashian culture, there is this idea that it's democracy, that everybody gets to express their opinion. That, as Kellyanne Conway and the White House people always like to talk about, is the elite media. In other words, anybody that is grounded in truth and professionalism is somehow an elitist. That seems to be the defense of the current White House.
Well, fine.
Well, let's talk about...
Let him have at it.
Right. Well, this guy could wake up on the wrong side of the bed and end the world. I mean, there's enormous power vested in him, and he seems to be one of the more scary people. You're concerned about him being a poor liar. I'm actually concerned about whether or not he's mentally ill.
Well, he's clearly mentally ill. I mean, there's this famous scene in Dr. Strangelove where the president demands to see this letter that has been written by Colonel Jack D. Ripper. Right. And he takes one look at the letter and says, it's obvious. This man is insane. The question is not whether he's crass, racist, insane, duplicitous. He's all of the above. The question is what to do about it. After Election Day, waking up one day and finding that you're in the middle of a nightmare, and do you stick your head in a hole in the ground and hope that it will go away? Do you fight against it? Is there really a way to fight against it?
Mm. Well, journalism is not about what you think, it's about what you can prove, and there's a certain discipline, and you know, and it's kind of offensive that people can have opinions that are, I mean, what was that famous expression of Senator Moynihan? Everybody's entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. And we're back to that again. But let's talk a little bit about being a documentarian. It's not that different from being a journalist. I think there are certain disciplines there in documentary filmmaking.
Well, I'm certainly proud to call myself a journalist, among other things. I have no problem with that at all. In fact, I'm honored by it, if anything.
Right. Well, in terms of then the purist in the documentary world, I believe you can't even do reconstructions. In Europe, they can reconstruct scenes and stuff in documentaries. But is there still a kind of barrier against it here, certainly in the news divisions, as far as I know?
I really don't know. I think there's less of a barrier.
Right.
But there's a deep misunderstanding about how documentaries should and could be made.
Right.
No one tells you how to craft your sentences as a journalist.
Right.
And no one should tell you how to craft your images as a documentary filmmaker. They can require one simple thing, however, and that you pursue the truth.
Right.
Whether you use reenactments, it's actually such a dumb conversation. I've had it over the years.
Right.
I find it dumber and dumber and dumber as time goes on.
Right.
You're not purporting to show what really happened. In the Thin Blue Line, where I used reenactments, reconstructions, whatever you want to call them, they're illustrations of what I believe were untruth in order to take you deeper into the mystery of what happened.
Right.
So it's a non-discussion. Right. It is really, really stupid.
I agree, and why not use the medium at your disposal, which you clearly do with great effect and great skill. And again, I'm speaking with Errol Morris, who's a writer and filmmaker, whose film The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature in 2004. He's the author of Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography, a book of his essays, and his latest book is A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald, both of which were New York Times bestsellers. His other films include Gates of Heaven, The Thin Blue Line, The Unknown Known, and his latest film is Wormwood, which will be out on Netflix on December the 15th. But let's talk about the film. In 1953, Frank Olson, a CIA employee, plunged out of a New York City hotel window. That's the beginning of a mystery that haunted his son throughout his life, right? And that's the main construct, if you will, of this story. And it leads to questions about whether or not he fell or was pushed and who pushed him and the extent to which he was involved in experiments involved with LSD. And I take it during the Rockefeller Commission, there was an admission on the part of the CIA that he had ingested LSD. But
he had been dosed with LSD, although they declined in their report to name the scientist. Yeah. His son, who was studying for a PhD at Harvard, realized the minute this commission report was published, they're talking about his father.
Right. So, but the Rockefeller Commission clearly didn't go very far, right? You've taken it obviously a lot further, and that is really at the heart of what the film's about, isn't it?
It's about a number of things.
Right, right.
It's about Frank Olson and his work on biological weapons. Right. It's about his son's 60-year-plus quest to uncover who killed his father and why. It's about our country and the growing need of the government to cover up what it's doing and to lie to its citizens. And I think it's a rather complex movie.
Well, it was, you know, obviously a very Manichaean time, the Cold War, but one of the great ironies to my mind about the Cold War is in many ways we created our own nemesis. You know, we sort of imitated the worst of the totalitarian systems that we were supposedly opposing. There was ultimately no difference between Stalin's purge trials and the House of Un-American Activities. They both asked the same question, are you not a communist? So it's a whole dark period, I think, in terms of the extent to which America mirrored the worst of its adversaries. And this seems to be an entry into that dark world of what did the government do in the name of defending America, killing their own?
Yes. Right. I think it is a dark world, and it may be a dark world that continues to the present time.
Well, it's true. They, you know, not to belabor the metaphor, but there are black budgets, and there are lots of activities, and particularly now with the Joint Special Operations Command, you know, has a bigger budget than the CIA. We don't quite know what they're up to. So is this unique to America, though, this kind of Manichaean idea that we have to, in effect, define ourselves via our enemies? Do we have to resort to this kind of activity?
It's hard to know what we've become and what defines us anymore. The only country that has refused to sign an agreement limiting greenhouse gases and carbon emissions. Who the hell are we?
Right. Well, we are. If we're not an outlaw, we're certainly an outlier.
It's very strange to have a government. I was a person who demonstrated against the Vietnam War years ago. I was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, which was politically active. But I never felt completely estranged from the government. I felt that the government was misguided. Now I have darker feelings. Like, what is my connection to this government? If this government just continues What is my connection to this when they don't espouse values which are important to me? What do I do? I started writing for the New York Times again. I have to finish an article. But there's a sense of despair that takes over at a certain point. Yes, I can write in the New York Times, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. But who's listening to anything anymore? There's just so much noise out there. A kind of tsunami of noise.
Well, that would be the ultimate Gordian knot. If you could tell me or tell our audience how we restore truth, restore a consensus about what is true and what is real, how we stop people from doing what they call reality shopping, where they find their own, you know, liberals get their news from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting. There's an atomization going on that is incredibly scary, and I don't know what it would take to cut through it and, you know, get people to... Now, maybe you're right. When at the beginning you said maybe we never agreed on things, but I think we're heading in a dangerous direction, and the last thing we want is to sort of increase the alienation that's already there. Does that worry you, that we are becoming so alienated from our own government? That,
of course it does.
Yeah.
In the 19th century, a German philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer, wrote an essay on how to win an argument any way you can. He somewhat cynically said, well, you can win an argument through logic or dialectic. Now, no one wins an argument through logic, he said, so let's just give 37, 38 ways to win an argument any way you can. The scary thing about it is truth. And even though truth has been questioned in so many, many, many ways, particularly in the current era, truth is truth. And that concept hasn't really changed at all. There are things that are true and there are things that are false. What's so amazing is to listen to people arguing about the size of inaugural crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you're going to lie about something where it isn't so obvious that you're lying. I don't know what to make of it.
Mm.
The internet, the millions of voices, myriad news outlets catering to every political opinion that you could imagine. It's pretty crazy out there.
Well, just in closing, back to your film, Wormwood, which, by the way, is mentioned in the book of Revelation. I don't know if you're aware of that passage or not.
Well, it's in the movie, so I think I am.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's also in Russian. It's Chernobyl, by the way.
I know that as well.
Yeah. So in this context of our conversation and this concern about our fact-free post-truth America, what are you hoping your film will do? Will it?
It's not a post-truth America. Let's be clear about that. Despite what anybody says, truth is truth. They can deny it. They can pretend that it doesn't exist. They can try to obfuscate it. They can impugn it, but it's still out there, as it always has been. How do you restore a kind of faith in truth? I really don't know. We live in such strange private domains. News that's fed to us on the basis of market surveys of what we might find acceptable or might be willing to believe.
Well, maybe we need to become citizens again and not consumers.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think it's a nice way of putting it. You can sit in front of a computer 24/7 and be fed huge amounts of information, and you don't even know exactly how the information is being dished out to you, what algorithms are grinding away somewhere. But there's still a sense of, I hope, there's a sense of truth and a sense of right and wrong. I used to talk about America's democracy as a fig leaf democracy. We all say we believe in equality, freedom, but it's qualified. And I think that's okay, as long as we pay lip service to fairness, equality, that's okay, because we're leaning in the right direction. We're trying to make the world a better place rather than a worse place. Nowadays, there seem to be too many people excited about making the world a worse place. And how to re-educate them, how to stop them, I don't know. I really actually don't know.
Well, we can only hope that good triumphs over evil, as Hollywood movies used to have the happy ending. And I thank you for joining us here today in studio, Earl Morris.
Hope I haven't been too depressing.
No, not at all. You're realistic. And frankly, I wake up every morning and realize that the bad guys appear to be winning and the good guys are absent. And it concerns me deeply. So there's no point in pretending otherwise. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
And again, I'll be speaking with Earl Morris, who's a writer and filmmaker, whose film The Fog of War, 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara, won the Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature in 2004. He's the author of Believing in Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography, a book of his essays, and his latest book is A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald, both of which were New York Times bestsellers, and his other films include Gates of Heaven, The Thin Blue Line, The Unknown Known, and his latest film is Wormwood, and it'll be out on Netflix on December the 15th. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the growth of a spin-off of the military-industrial complex Eisenhower warned about, the nuclear-industrial complex.
Crazy. What is it, the attic? I am crazy. Sure, we got fishing. Mother, do you think they'll drop the bomb? Mother, do you think they'll like this song?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, Massive Overkill, brought to you by the Nuclear Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And last week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by the Republican Bob Corker, had hearings questioning President Trump's mental suitability to be the steward of the nuclear arsenal and his temperament to have access to the nuclear button. There's something going on with Donald Trump in terms of some kind of fetish about nuclear weapons. He said some strange things about what, you know, if we have them, why don't we use them? Encourage the South Koreans and the Japanese to get nuclear weapons. So apparently, in his briefings in the transition in Trump Tower, he kept asking the briefers about what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. A guy that's sort of a megalomaniac who's obviously interested in power and self-aggrandizement. Is that something that we should be concerned about, the combination of Donald Trump's psyche and nuclear weapons?
Absolutely. You know, he said other things, like in one of the debates, they asked him about the nuclear triad, which obviously was above his pay grade to explain. But he did say that, you know, the devastation caused by nuclear weapons is very important to him. Now, does that mean for deterrence? Does that mean to use them? You know, he didn't say. Also, they showed him some sort of chart, I think over the summer, of, you know, how many nuclear warheads the U.S. used to have, how many they have now. And they have, in fact, come down, but they're still enough to end life as we know it. And he was furious. It's like, well, why don't we have what we used to have? And let's, you know, get 10 times as many. And they had to sort of walk him off the ledge and explain that the U.S. industrial base couldn't actually produce that many at this point. And, of course, his name-calling with Kim Jong-un and his kind of ability to flip back and forth. You know, if you flatter him, he gives you a pass for a while, and if you seem to give him a slight hem, he's furious. And so he's incredibly unpredictable, and he does fly off the handle. And the thing is, under the U.S. system, he has the sole power to decide to launch one of these things. So, yes, I think it's very concerning. And Ella Corker did not do a great job in the hearings of really pushing the point. He has raised this very question before about whether Trump is the kind of person who would get us into World War III. And he, you know, he's a Republican, and he's, you know, not by no means a liberal. Of course, there wouldn't be such a thing in the Republican Party these days.
So one of the, I thought, the more encouraging things about humankind was that we seem to have dodged the bullet of a nuclear war after decades of the Cold War, where both the Soviet Union and the United States could destroy each other within 30 minutes, and that the best defense that was offered up to the American people and the Russian people was that you'll die, but the other side will die as well. Hardly anything to do with the traditional notion in warfare of victory. Yet we lived with that for decades, and it sort of went away, but now it's coming back. And what's making nuclear weapons relevant again?
Well, I think part of it is Trump's obsession with it. Part of it is the nuclear complex is sort of on autopilot. It's like it has to modernize regardless of the strategic situation. You know, the Pentagon launched this big rebuilding project under Obama, which was supposed to cost $1 trillion over 30 years. And now the Congressional Budget Office says, well, actually, adjusting for inflation, it'll be more like $1.7 trillion for new submarines, new bombers, new missiles, new warheads. And for what? I mean, the United States already has nuclear overkill, but it seems like some of the kind of members of the nuclear priesthood who we had hoped were long forgotten are kind of rearing their ugly heads again. And so there's talk in Trump's nuclear posture review that's going to come out of quote-unquote usable low-yield nuclear weapons that, you know, are more credible and could be used in a crisis without causing undue, you know, devastation. But, of course, their idea of a low-yield weapon is similar to what was used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that killed hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, I think possibly the other thing is there's an imbalance, you know, versus the Soviet Union. There was no question of attacking them. North Korea has perhaps a dozen warheads and missiles that might or might not reach the United States versus 4,000 in the U.S. stockpile and missiles in at sea and on land and bombers that have been tested and would certainly work in an attack on North Korea. So then it's just, you know, does Trump understand the devastation not only to North Korea but to South Korea, the impacts in Japan and China, you know, that a nuclear weapon is not a precise weapon and it causes, you know, it would kill millions of people. But is he the kind of person who would say, as I believe Lindsey Graham says, well, that would all happen over there, you know?
Yeah, well, there's no over there when it comes to nuclear fallout, is there?
No, exactly. And there's been studies by Physicians for Social Responsibility that, you know, a relatively small nuclear exchange relative to the size of global arsenals would cause mass famine because you wouldn't be able to grow things anymore in large parts of the world. So this idea that these are usable in any way, shape, or form is a fantasy. But you never know what Trump understands and what he doesn't. I mean, I think certainly people around him realize this, but, you know, in a crisis, would their opinions count, you know?
And again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who is the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His books include How Much You're Making on the War Daddy, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, Massive Overkill Brought to You by the Nuclear-Industrial Complex. So we know about the military-industrial complex, which was the term was coined in President Eisenhower's farewell address. Originally, in the original draft of the address, it was the military-industrial congressional complex. But his brother Milton thought, since he was addressing the Congress, it probably was wise to take out that reference to the Congress. But that's a key part of it. But now you're talking about the nuclear industrial complex. Tell us about that. What are the elements of the nuclear industrial complex?
Well, it's a subset of the larger military industrial complex, but it's the part that really, I think, sparked Eisenhower's interest and concern and the fact that he gave this speech, because one thing that he had to fight was a new strategic bomber that the Air Force and the contractors wanted that he didn't think was necessary. And he originally tried to cancel it, and then under pressure he brought it back again, and then finally McNamara did it in when Kennedy came to office. But between that and the big push about the missile gap, a lot of that propaganda was supported by industry, by generals who were basically insubordinate. He was the commander-in-chief. They were out there criticizing him as being soft in his nuclear buildup. So those things, I think, stuck with him when he decided to discuss the military-industrial complex. And, of course, you had the Manhattan Project, one of the largest research projects in history, which created the template for the current nuclear weapons complex that builds nuclear warheads. So, you've got labs in California and New Mexico. You've got uranium production in Tennessee. You've got a plant in Kansas City that makes non-nuclear parts for nuclear weapons, a plant in Texas that assembles and disassembles the warheads. Of course, you have the Nevada test site. And then you've got missiles deployed in places like Wyoming and Montana and North Dakota. And the members from those states are very ferociously guarding those missiles that they not be eliminated in any way, shape, or form. And then you've got nuclear submarines built in Connecticut. So you've got a mixture of Democrats and Republicans, different regions, all with an economic stake and kind of a pork barrel politics stake in perpetuating the nuclear weapons buildup.
Well, interestingly, Eisenhower, I think in many ways, was prompted to make that speech because of the U-2 incident, which he felt he was blindsided by the CIA on that. Because they assured him that the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, would not survive and that the Russians would have no evidence, because the cover story was that it was a U.S. weather aircraft that strayed off course. But the context is that Khrushchev had made a trip to the United States, which was very successful, and he and Eisenhower hit it off. And as you know, remember perhaps, William Hartung, the Khrushchev wanted to go to Disneyland. He had to settle for going to a movie set and meeting Shirley MacLaine. But he had a really good time, and the reciprocal visit was planned between Eisenhower and Khrushchev in Crimea. Khrushchev even built a golf course for Ike in the Soviet Union, and they were prepared to end the Cold War. And they both had to fight off their military-industrial complexes on both sides. And the U-2 incident just absolutely blew up that possibility of Eisenhower capping his legacy as a two-term president with a peace deal with the Russians and perhaps the end of the Cold War. And there's still a lot of mystery about the U-2 and how that happened. And I don't know whether you could make the case that the hawks on both sides somehow conspired. But how much does the military-industrial complex drive the situation on the ground? Because I find it so extraordinary that we are spending more today than we did at the height of the Cold War, and we really don't have any enemies. I mean, as far as I can tell, the only enemies we have are the ones that we just got rid of, by and large, in Raqqa and Mosul in the Middle East. And these are just a bunch of crazy psychotics driving around in pickup trucks.
Well, there's no adversary that would justify this huge level of spending or the type of weapons that the U.S. is purchasing or that are necessarily even to be dealt with by traditional military means. So, you know, yes, there's groups like Boko Haram and there's kind of, you know, lone wolf terrorists who take action in the United States and they look at some, you know, ISIS propaganda on the internet and so forth. But those issues are not going to be dealt with strategic bombers and long-range ballistic missiles, or for that matter, large numbers of troops or fighter planes or so forth. So I think, you know, they're basically, it's kind of an equation that only works emotionally, which is that if there's a climate of fear, a lot of people feel like, well, more is probably better, and they don't investigate the details, you know, whether the things that are being built bear any relationship to the security challenges that are actually out there. So it's almost like an archaeological dig. I mean, we've got weapons that were kind of for the Cold War. We've got weapons that were for, you know, the Persian Gulf War. And now we've got cyber weapons. You know, there's counterinsurgency-related weapons. It's like, you know, they add these layers of weaponry and troops and so forth that were developed at different times for different purported threats. And then nothing ever goes away. And part of that is because Congress, you know, they're not going to let a production line close down if they can avoid it. Part of it is I just think a great kind of confusion in the military. There's a lot of people at the lower levels who realize that what we're doing makes no sense, but they don't necessarily get heard.
And let's take a brief station break, and we'll continue the conversation with William Hartung.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Luxembourg. Ask me, because if it's not love, then it's the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb, the bomb that will bring us together.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with William Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His latest book is Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and he has an article at Tom Dispatch, Massive Overkill, brought to you by the Nuclear Industrial Complex. So this military-industrial complex, and now the subset, the nuclear industrial complex that you write about in your piece, William Hartung, are often described as a form of military Keynesianism. Is that what drives the Congress? Is this a sort of failure of us as a culture that we cannot find more creative ways to employ people, that we have to have them making these sort of dead-end weapons that we're not supposed to ever use? I mean, that in itself is an absurdity, isn't it? Spending trillions of dollars to build something that you can't use. If you do use, it's the end of the world. Surely we could find better ways to employ people.
Well, definitely. I mean, there's been studies that have shown that weapon spending is the least effective way to create jobs. Infrastructure would create maybe 1.5 times as many jobs for the money spent, or alternative energy, or education, even more than that. But of course, that would require different priorities in Washington. You know, if you're in a community and your choice is $1 billion to build a nuclear submarine from the federal government or nothing, that's not really a choice economically. But if there were other things that the federal government was investing in, that would be different. But the military has been given a special status. I mean, essentially, we have a military-industrial policy, which if it was done in any other sector of the economy, the right would be screaming socialism. You know, so the Pentagon and its contractors get this special status, and therefore there's a dependency on the money that flows through there that is artificial. And if you look at things like how much of our government-sponsored R&D comes from the Pentagon, that could be done directly. I mean, if there's things that you want to develop in the civilian economy, you don't have to do it as a spin-off from, you know, building a ballistic missile. You could approach the problem directly, but that's very difficult to do in our the way our economy is structured. So I think there's kind of the fetishism of the military, but there's also this notion that we, this kind of mythology that we live in a free market, and somehow anything other than investing in the military is viewed with suspicion by many people.
So you could make the case that it's sort of right-wing welfare, but except for the fact that Eisenhower's speech coining the phrase the military-industrial complex was in many ways targeted at the Democrats, because it was people, Democrats like Stuart Symington and others, that were ladling out the pork and wanted to build all these, I think it was the, was it the B-36 bomber that was a complete turkey that he championed?
Yes, yes. And he very much wanted the Atlas missile, which was at that time was a new generation of ballistic missiles. And it ends up, he had a close connection with Convair, which produced that. So that's very kind of modern seeming, because we have a lot of that, of course, currently. The revolving door and the coziness of industry with the Pentagon and the Congress, which leads to the situation of weapons we don't need at these immense costs.
Well, there was also another scandal, and that is that when Symington, I think, was Secretary of the Air Force, he killed the Northrop Flying Wing, which was a revolutionary plane, and they've only recently come up with the sort of reincarnation, which is the B-2 bomber. But back then, it was just, what, in the early 60s, the Flying Wing broke all kinds of records. It was an extraordinarily advanced aircraft, and Symington not only ordered it killed, but he ordered them to destroy every copy of the plane. And, you know, because it was, you know, a rival to the garbage that he wanted to, this ridiculous plane that he wanted to have the Air Force buy. So it's extraordinary when you think about it that these so-called patriots deny the American military the best weapon system in order to raid the treasury.
Yes. I mean, they're not even intelligent militarists, you know, because they're so compromised. And, you know, there was a move in the 80s, this sort of military reform caucus in the Congress that fed off of information from people like Franklin Spinney, a Pentagon whistleblower. And basically they were saying, you know, you're building all these very high-tech, unsustainable weapons. You can't even get them out of the hangar half the time. You're building them in smaller numbers. There's other kinds of systems that you could build in greater numbers that would be more reliable, that would be cheaper, that would probably have, you know, better military effect. But those weren't the things that were the biggest money, that were had the best connections in Congress, that, you know, for this kind of behemoth to shift gears to producing something new, even if they're moving from one weapon to another, is very difficult because of the jobs argument and of course the flow of money of the contractors. Because if there's a pause in the mass production and you're doing research for the next generation, during that fallow period the companies aren't making as much money.
So what did you make of, I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes interview with Steve Bannon a while back, where he said that it doesn't make any sense to spend $1 trillion on modernizing nuclear weapons. It's just a huge waste of money. We'd rather make a deal with Putin to end the Cold War. That was his answer to justify the possibility of some kind of collusion going on between Trump and Putin. It's a sort of, on the surface, it makes an awful lot of sense. But, of course, the reality is that Putin's not interested in ending the Cold War. He wants a new Cold War. It's the only justification he has for plundering the country is that the outside enemy is at the gates.
Yes, and, of course, Bannon is not, on one hand, the most reliable figure. On the other hand, he may well believe that. I mean, he has other fish to fry. You know, he's a white supremacist. He's an extreme nationalist. And, you know, a deal with Putin is not inconsistent with pushing that kind of agenda in other parts of the world. Nonetheless, it would reduce the chances that there's a nuclear confrontation. So there's a logic there in the midst of kind of the dangerous mess of hatred that is Stephen Bannon. But yes, I mean, Putin, you know, if there were truly a more peaceful world, his rationale for being an autocrat would be diminished if he didn't have that outside threat to point to. If it was a more peaceful world, you know, the corruption, all the stuff that's kind of excused because allegedly he's at the barricades defending Russia would go away, and his ability to hold power would probably be much less than it is now.
So what can the citizens listening to us here at Thanksgiving, when families get together and people celebrate what they can be thankful for, and here we are depressing the hell out of them that the country's investing in death, not in life. Our priorities are screwed up. We thought we'd gotten over this nightmare in the Cold War, and here we are back again reviving nuclear weapons.
Well, I think it is an occupational hazard of mine to be talking about these things all the time. My friends are always asking me how I can possibly do this. But the reason I do it is because it's a reality and it's got to be confronted. And, you know, there are some interesting things happening globally. I mean, the UN passing this nuclear weapons ban, which, of course, was not acceded to by any of the major nuclear powers, but I think at least it puts them on the moral and political defensive, and a lot of the countries that just kind of blindly followed them during the debates over the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was supposed to be a deal where new countries didn't get nuclear weapons and the major powers got rid of theirs, and of course they haven't, and so countries were frustrated, and they hitched themselves to this push by non-governmental organizations to have this treaty. There's also this pressure in the United States, as we mentioned, to try to limit the ability of a single person to launch a nuclear weapon, which is a difficult thing to pull off. But I think even changing the climate of the conversation might increase the possibility of somebody intervening were Trump to try to do this. It has happened apparently with Richard Nixon, where Secretary of Defense Schlesinger said, you know, this guy's a little off. If he gives any orders, run them by me, you know. So it's difficult, but I think also there is, you know, I think there's support for getting rid of this waste and the pork barrel politics and so forth in different parts of the spectrum. You know, the head of the Sea Power Committee in the House, Randy Forbes, was defeated by a Tea Partier, even though he was bringing home the bacon in terms of shipbuilding contracts. So there were people who felt more committed to shrinking government than they did to the military-industrial complex. And, you know, likewise, Trump used to give speeches where he'd say things like, you know, there's these special interests in Washington, and they're making us build missiles we don't need because they're lining their pockets and so forth. And he would, you know, to great cheers from his crowds. Now, of course, Trump, you can't trust him as far as you can throw him, but the fact that that resonated in his part of his base makes me think that there still may be a spark to be had going up against some of this stuff. I think in the short term, you know, we're riding out a very difficult period with Trump, but I don't think he's going to be president forever. I think things can be turned around. And even people like Bernie Sanders, who steered clear of foreign policy for the most part in the his presidential run, have started to speak to these issues. And particularly he has looked at the kind of corporate angle, how it's part of this larger corporate oligarchy that's in many ways running the world into the ground. So, you know, I think there are some signs of hope. Reverend Barber, who ran the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina, is trying to start a poor people's campaign modeled on Martin Luther King's campaign at the end of his life. And one of the planks of that is defeating militarism. So, you know, compared to what we're up against and the money on the other side and so forth, it's a beginning. But certainly we have a long way to go. But, you know, if I look at Reagan, for example, who started out joking about bombing the Soviet Union and whose aides said, oh, you know, with enough shovels we can survive a nuclear conflict, came around to he can't win a nuclear war, to doing some reductions, even almost cutting a deal with Gorbachev for nuclear abolition. A lot of people on the right say, well, that's what a wonderful man he was, and you know, so forth. But in fact, he was turned around in significant part by the global nuclear disarmament movement, both the European nuclear disarmament movement, nuclear freeze movement, a million people in Central Park in 1982. And they made a calculation, in fact, when he was running for re-election, that, you know, they said, well, you know, this is spreading too far now. It's in the churches. It's in the mainstream. It's not just a bunch of, you know, ragtag political activists. And therefore, we may pay a price politically if we don't come up with a proposal, you know, to deal with this. And of course, one proposal was Star Wars, which was a technical fix and was a charade. But the other fix was he actually, pushed by George Shultz and others, did come around to some nuclear weapons reduction. So, you know, that we've been in tough spots before where things have been turned around. The thing I wonder now is whether we have the patience to build that kind of political movement, and if we can dodge the outrages of the day that Trump puts out there that I think can be distracting to building any kind of longer-term political project.
Well, the other thing that changed Reagan from a hawk to a dove was the Able Archer exercise in 1983, a NATO exercise to practice for the preemptive launch of nuclear weapons, because NATO's policy was that we reserve the right to strike first because of the preponderance of conventional weaponry in the Warsaw Pact. Of course, the Warsaw Pact was a total fiction, as we learned later, when the Berlin Wall came down. But then that was always the sort of logic, if you will. And the Russians were totally paranoid about this exercise. They believed it was a feint for a real attack, but mostly because the gerontocracy in the Kremlin had been convinced by the KGB, who showed them videos of Ronald Reagan talking about the evil empire and the mending up on the ash heap of history, and Cap Weinberg talking about nuclear decapitation. The old crocs in the Kremlin took that quite personally, and they were, after a series of escalations with the Pershing missiles being deployed and the shooting down of the KL-007, and things were getting really tense, and then there was the Grenada war that came out of nowhere that was largely designed to take the Marine barracks bombing in Lebanon off the headlines. All this led to the gerontocracy in the Kremlin to believe Reagan meant it, and they were about to preempt an imaginary attack. And only because of a double agent working for the British intelligence that was in the KGB were able to learn about what the other side was thinking and immediately end the exercise. And when Reagan was told about that, how he was having fun, you know, taunting the wounded bear, because he's, after all, a Hollywood actor and was enjoying the lines. But the idea that he suddenly realized, my God, the consequences are that I could have ended the world with my loose lips. And after that, he became much, much more serious. And of course, it took a while before Gorbachev came along, but then when he found a partner. But we're back to that situation now with Trump and Kim Jong-un. You know, we think we're virtuous, but from where Kim Jong-un is sitting, he thinks there's a madman in the White House out to kill him.
Exactly. And even if Trump were bluffing, words have consequences when you're the commander-in-chief of a country that's got a stockpile of 4,000 nuclear warheads. And so... from the North Korea side, how are they supposed to decide which things are Trump mouthing off and which things are serious, especially when he kind of goes back and forth the way that he does? So I don't know if Trump is capable of fully understanding that. I mean, he certainly enjoys that kind of, you know, insult by Twitter approach to governing. But somebody needs to get a handle on that, I think, because I think it's dangerous in its own right. Whatever he may have in his mind, those kinds of threats can lead to unintended consequences.
But along with what you were saying earlier, William Hartung, about the need for people to get active, would it make sense to organize a movement around a call for a psychological evaluation of Trump and perhaps remove him from office simply because he's a danger to the world, because you simply cannot have somebody with his mental instability able to destroy the world if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed.
Well, there's a book to that effect, which I have not read. I've just seen the reviews of. And I don't know, in Congress, there's people who've certainly suggested that this is the case, that he's too unstable to be entrusted with the power that he has. And so I don't know. I think it's as a kind of parallel effort, it could make a lot of sense, because also if his presence in that position is heightening the danger, getting him out of there may make it easier to fight the longer fight, because ultimately it's not, no president should have that power, but not in particular, not this one.
Well, it's an extraordinary situation. Again, this may seem like an odd conversation at Thanksgiving, but I don't think there's anything more serious than what's happening with this aberration that we have with the worst president in American history, somebody that's so dangerous and so manifestly unqualified, and a bunch of greedy contractors who just want to loot the treasury. That's a recipe for disaster.
It's a terrible combination. And according to some recent reports in places like Defense News, defense stocks are up 40% since Trump took office. And a lot of that's not even the flows of money. It's just the generation of fear and the assumption that that will lead to military buildups in the future. So, you know, the market often is kind of fickle or goes on, you know, kind of short-term information. But nonetheless, the industry and Wall Street seem to think that Trump is going to, you know, be a huge boon to that sector. And he has. I mean, you know, the stock increases is a real value to them.
Well, William Hartung, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And he has an article at Tom Dispatch, Massive Overkill, brought to you by the Nuclear-Industrial Complex. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.